Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Monday, March 25th. My name is Rob Doster. I have a fun show on the way for you today. I was able to catch up with my buddy Dallin Cuff from ESPN, and we talked all about the first weekend of the NCAA tournament. We got into the Duke-UCF controversial finish. We talked about whether or not Tennessee can be trusted, the biggest surprises and the biggest disappointments of the first round, and, of course, the best place to be if you are traveling to games for the second weekend of the NCAA tournament. Before I get into that conversation, I have to make the usual ask. Please rate, please review, please subscribe to this podcast and any app that you listen to podcasts in. Any interaction with this episode or this podcast or this series in that app, it really does help. It helps us in the metrics. It helps us in the rankings. And in March, it is never more important for us to have good metrics and good rankings. So if you enjoy what you hear in this conversation, just please throw me 5 stars. Say something nice about me in the reviews. It really will help. It makes my bosses happy. When my bosses are happy, I'm happy. When I'm happy, you are getting a better podcast. So really, it just helps you out in the long run and makes your day that much better. I thank you for it. Now let's get into that conversation with Dallin Cuff. And now let me welcome back onto the podcast noted Arsenal fan and my favorite ESPN broadcaster, one Mr. Dallin Cuff. Dallin, what's going on, man? I understand that you are currently running errands for your wife while she's home taking care of your daughter. First and foremost, congratulations, man. I'm happy for you.
Thanks, man. Congrats to you, too. You're a two-week-old. That's good stuff. We're 5 months in here, and obviously this time of year, I haven't been home in 3 weeks. So, I'm fitting this in because you're the man. I want to talk about what happened in the tournament. We can lay off of the soccer conversation for another time, though. I know you guys have a big week coming up for the Spurs.
I can't talk about Tottenham right now. They're killing me, man. It's breaking my heart because it's going to collapse. This is going to be the Spursiest moment of it all.
It would be painful. I mean, if they fall out of the top four, that would be one of the most epic collapses I've ever seen. I don't think it can happen, but they're on the. It's there. I just don't think it will happen.
If there's someone that can do it, it's Tottenham Hotspur. That's who.
I do have trust in that for sure.
Me too, man. That's the problem. So let's start with this. You've been on the road for 3 weeks. Give me the craziest game you've been to, craziest thing that you've done, the most fun environment that you were at. Like, what's been the best part of this March for you so far?
Well, I mean, my role is primarily in studio. The only time they let me out of the cage occasionally is I got to call the Ivy semifinal and the Ivy final, which was awesome. It was a great event. Harvard and Yale, I think that was good for the country to see, for people to tune into that game, because I've been saying this for years now. The perception of the Ivy League is this slow, methodical, you know, only jump shooters. And that's what it was 10 years when I played the league 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and all before that. Now the league is high-paced, high-level athletes, you know, potential pros and Yeoni and other guys. And I think the country got to see that. And everybody I've talked to that saw that game, because it was in a good window, that Sunday noon game. It's the only game on ESPN2 at the time, for at least that first hour before the SEC final took place. And that first half was just, I mean, it was up and down, almost 100 points scored in the half. So it was a lot of fun. It was a good showcase to the league. Other than that, we do a lot of stuff in studio, obviously. But it's been a fun March. It's a busy March. And, it's been, I guess, kind of what we thought it would be, in the regard that I think we, you, me, anybody that follows the game closely, have pretty clear that there was a delineation between the top teams and everybody else in this year's tournament, in this year's college basketball, you know, the season. And I think that's come to fruition in the tournament here, as we've seen, you know, a lack of competitive games between the top teams, the exception of Duke, and there's a couple exceptions, but the majority of them, I believe every betting favorite covered this weekend and the second round of games, which has never happened before.
Yeah, and that was good for me because that got me back into the black when it comes to the gambling side of things.
Good for you. That's all that matters.
I made an unbelievable rally last night with Houston and Oregon coming through for me. So it's not a bad day in the Doster household today. And we're going to get into like the Duke UCF stuff. But I do want to get your take on this real quick. I know that the first weekend, we had like two great games and a couple of pretty good games and like one game-winning shot. But for the most part, it was a pretty boring first weekend. I personally think that this is a good thing moving forward, because now if you look at it, if you were to do a 16-team bracket, like at the start of March, everyone available for you to pick from, a 16-team bracket. I don't know how many changes you would make from what we have right now versus anything that you could take, any teams that you could pick. So I think that what we have going forward is nothing but like great games. And I'm so fired up for the Sweet 16. There's so many great matchups moving forward. And I think that that's actually a good thing. You know, you want those upsets early. You want the chalk late. You want those big boys battling. You want to see the big matchups, the best teams in the country playing. So I'm kind of happy with where we are right now. Are you on the same page?
I mean, I think you're right. I do love the drama of the Cinderella. I love the teams making a run. Well, I was joking with Matt Barry when we were in studio during Champ Week because it was you know, very much like, I don't want to see Loyola Chicago. I don't want to see that. I want Duke. I want Kansas. I want Kentucky. And I kept calling him an elitist. I was just messing around. But there's something to that, you know, you want to have, when we get to the Final Four, you want to have the big boys playing, the Elite Eight, you want to have the big boys playing. I do love the fact of seeing a team that's been good all year. I mean, Loyola Chicago was a really good team last year, for example, and found a way to make a run in the tournament. And that's I think that's exciting. VCU in 2011 is totally, it's different. They snuck in and get the last at-large bid, and they show why they got that chance and why they had the opportunity, and they capitalized on the opportunities. I do enjoy seeing those. You know, one team in the mix, you know, when it's, you know, 3-4 in the Sweet 16, I don't love that because it usually means one of the big boys or two got knocked out by having a bad performance. So you're right. Where we're at right now is going to give us the best chance to see the best hoops. Up until this point, though, it's been a very lackluster and less than exciting NCAA tournament.
Yeah, and maybe I'm just trying to talk myself into this actually, like, still being exciting. That might be – maybe I have a little bit of – maybe I have some Stockholm syndrome going on. That might be what it is. So let's talk about that Duke-UCF finish. I don't necessarily have a huge problem with it because I think that some of the calls that were missed by the officials at the end, they were obviously went in favor of Duke at the very, very end, but it'd be hard for me to say that Duke got the benefit of the whistle for the entirety of that second half. Where do you stand on that finish?
Yeah, I don't think the referees, I mean, you're not going to be perfect, but I don't blame anything on the referees for very honest. I mean, this is what was really unfortunate for UCF and for their fans and for Aubrey Dawkins in particular. That young man played an outstanding game.
He was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
But that 2-on-1 where he tried to crank it home, if he caught and tried to really hammer, they would put them up 6 with less than 2 minutes to go, and that might have been the nail in the coffin. He misses that dunk. They come down, Kim Reynolds bangs a triple. It's now a 1-point game, massive 5-point swing. And then missing that tip in, although it's a tough tip, it's one that he probably makes 85 times out of 100, 90 times out of 100. Just to miss that and to have that, and for him to have to carry that along with him the rest of his life, because it's not going to go. Every tournament that comes up, I swear, I don't know how you wouldn't be as a competitor be able to forget that, especially if Duke goes on to win this thing. And everybody knows the teams that win usually have one crazy scare where they make a last-second shot or something happens to allow them to continue and survive in advance, and they capitalize on that. I'm not saying that's a foregone conclusion, but if Duke does do that, this is that moment that people are going to remember that missed, particularly the missed tip-in, but I go back to the missed dunk because that, I think, effectively might end the game. And it's my heart breaks for him because of how well he played, and his dad coached a great game, throwing in, I was triangling twos at times and boxing one defenses and, you know, letting Goldwire and Jones just take shots and play. I mean, they were just doing stuff that you have to do to beat Duke, but they were creative and crafty in their and how they what defense they dialed up at what times, how they guarded guys, how they were able to finish and make big plays. It's just so unfortunate that it comes down to a couple missed opportunities that young man makes a lot of times, and it will overshadow what was a spectacular performance.
Yeah, the you're right about the dunk being the one that he's going to carry with him for a while because the tipping is makeable, but that's still a tough shot like flying through the line and tipping in. And like if you watch the replay from the top of the backboard, the angle that they had there, like he was full extension laying that thing in. That was not necessarily an easy finish, but you're right. That's one that he can make. The alley-oop though, you know, I don't have a problem with them throwing that pass because I think that's the right pass to make. And when you're as athletic as Aubrey Dawkins is, like that's not catching a ball and dunking it is not necessarily the most difficult thing in the world. For me, that would be very, very hard to do. I don't know how athletic you are these days, yeah. Dallin, but I'm guessing that it's probably
not happening.
Yeah, so for him...
That's not going down. But now that's also why I said the tip-in, because of how good he is and kind of player
yep.
he is.
Yep, yep.
That he can make that. And that's the thing. If it's a lesser player, then I would I think he would beat himself up less and would be less affected by. We've seen guys miss tips at the end of games all the time. Big man gets it, fakes, and misses a layup or misses a one-handed tip. I just know how great of a player he is that's something that he can do.
Yeah, I hope what he takes with them is the fact that they were in a position for him, I don't want to say for him to lose the game, but for that game to be lost in the way that it was lost was because he turned into Kobe Bryant for 39 minutes of that game. He was unbelievable. He might have, he might have gotten himself somewhere close to the NBA with that performance. I bet he gets a tryout, a roster spot. I would not be surprised to see him in an NBA game at some point next season, man. When you're that athletic and you can make shots the way that he can make shots, there's not many people that can do that. Last thing on Duke before we move on. For me, like, I'm not all that much more worried about them going forward than I was before this matchup, because I think that UCF is kind of like uniquely suited to being able to slow down Duke. They have the athletes on the perimeter, they have the size up front, and they have the big fella. Taco Fall is one of the 40 tallest people in the world. There's no one else in college basketball that you could put in front of the rim and have him be able to protect the rim the way that he can protect the rim. And with the way that Duke plays, with all that driving and all that finishing at the basket and all that kind of, for lack of a better term, bully ball that they like to play, you know, I just think that UCF was the perfect matchup that executed the perfect game plan and had their kids play an absolutely unbelievable game. It was a perfect storm of sorts for Duke to be able to be in the situation where they probably should have lost. I don't think that this makes me concerned moving forward, because I don't know how many teams are going to be able to do what UCF did.
Yeah, that's. I mean, we talked about it on SportsCenter right after that matchup got locked in. For all the reasons you listed, and particularly Taco Fall, it's in a quick turnaround to prepare how we're going to guard him, how we're going to attack him, and the guys have to feel it out at first on both sides of the ball to get comfortable. Okay, here's what I can do against him. He's like, at times, try to put him out of your head, which is harder, easier said than done. Even if you have a lane, you've got to find a way to try to finish that before he gets there, or how we're going to defend him. And you take some time to feel that out. You couple that with Aubrey making shots like he was yesterday, and the fact that, again, how they were defended. Now, Duke shot the ball well for the majority of that game, with the exception, Trey hit a big three they needed to make, you know. They shot the ball well from three comparatively. I think it was 42% in the first game. I think they were just around 40 yesterday, which is better than they had been all season by almost 10 percentage points. And at this stage, you see those 10 percentage points would be the difference in them winning and losing yesterday. So that is the model for how you have to beat them. The difference is they have a unique personnel to be able to do that. Now, there might be teams down the road that can do stuff similar. And we saw Virginia Tech when they beat them in Blacksburg earlier in the year, they really did the same thing, where how they kind of just zoned up Trey Jones, clogged up the lane. Now, there was no Zion in that game. He can still find a way to make plays, but I'm interested to see when a team that's already seen them before, has had success against them before on the defensive end, although without Zion, how they go about that in the next round, because I think they also are suited. Also, when you play in that same conference and you see those four letters across the other opponent's shirt all the time, they're not intimidated at all by Duke. They see them all the time. They play against them every year. And they've beaten them three straight years in Blacksburg. So this team, I think, is also suited to really give Duke a challenge. The personnel a little different, but UCF capitalized as much as they could on their opportunity and falling just short. Virginia Tech's going to give them a battle.
So the other thing that I'm kind of concerned about moving forward is Tennessee. And tell me what you think about this. So the Vols blew two big leads, right? And they still found a way to come back and win those games, despite the fact that they blew those leads in the second half. So are you worried that this is a team that can't hold a lead and a team that is going to throw something away when they face somebody better than an Iowa or better than a Colgate? Or is this the kind of thing where you're like, well, you know what? They got a little bit of mental toughness. They blew a 25-point lead, but they still won in overtime.
Yeah, I think it's more the latter. And actually, for me, it's something else for them. And I think it's been indicative of their defensive performance all year. Is there a senior-laden team that knows they're really talented, and they can get a little complacent. And I think that's how they ended up not winning the SEC. It's because they, particularly defensive end, they didn't really guard till the last 3 weeks of the season. And this is a team that last year was top 10 in the nation in defensive efficiency. This year they were hovering in the 30s, 40s for a while, and got themselves down to the 30s. And they're capable of being a top 10 team. It's all the same guys with the same athleticism, same drive, the understanding, but defensive desire. You got to really want to do it. And at times, I think they know, man, we can just go out and score these dudes. We're just better than these dudes. And they are in a lot of games, in almost every game. But when they've got to really guard, they've struggled. Now, where that translates to the tournament for me is when they get up, they have a little bit of a complacency in them to be like, oh, man, we're routing these guys again. And they're nice. They are nice. They have a level of confidence and swagger, and that's, you know, earned and deserved. But I think going forward, why I'm not that concerned is now when you look across the line and it's not a 15-seed Colgate, it's not an Iowa team that's been up and down all year that you've been dominating for the first 15 minutes, 20 minutes of the game, really. It's, you know, you're looking at Purdue. You're looking at Virginia. I don't think you're – I think this is the time these guys have been waiting for. This is the mentality of those seniors has been like, get us – we need to get to this point again. First of all, get over the hump they did yesterday and then continue forward. I think we're going to see their best basketball. I do think that that helps them remain focused. Even in games when they're up, I think they respect their opponents enough and will not get complacent. And I do think most times I say you can't turn a switch on and off. With a senior group, sometimes you can. And I think we've seen it already this year. And I think they'll be switched on for the remainder of the tournament.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And, you know, it just I don't think Grant Williams is going to let them lose. There have been like four or five games this year where he has absolutely taken over down the stretch. And he did that again on Sunday. Like, he's not a guy, I like to use the term like layup line scout, right? Like, he's not a guy that is a layup line scout. He's not a guy that jumps off the page to you if you just kind of look at his measurables. He's not somebody where, you know, if you're watching him play for 5 minutes, you're going to be like, oh, wow, he's the best player on the floor. But you keep watching him and, you know, whether it was the block that he had on Tyler Cook or whether it was those like three tough jumpers that he made to start the overtime or the pass that he had to Jordan Bone for that, was it like he had a 25 footer in overtime. When it comes down to it, I don't know if there's a guy that I want with the ball in his hands and the game on the line more than Grant Williams.
I think you're right. I mean, he's been so seasoned with it, and they can use him in different ways. They can put him on the low block. They put him in the elbow area, the free throw line, where they're deadly when they do that, because when they take away the help side on either side and they have him in the middle of the court, he is such a handful. And even when you know he's going to dribble and spin back, like he's coming back to that spin all the time, you still can't stop it. And a lot of times he gets fouled and he's strong enough to go through you and finish. And if you play him off the block and you double him, he's able to facilitate. And his comfort level in those situations and their team's understanding of how to play off of him really does take them to a different level in late game situations where they have the utmost confidence and belief that they can make plays and they'll play through him. And when you look around the rest of the tournament, I'm not sure, to your point, there's another guy that I feel as confident with because they've done it before. Now, maybe not on this stage, but when you look around, whether it's Duke, those are guys that haven't done it before. If you look at Purdue and Carson Edwards, he's going to have to be the guy. You know, he's put up 40 points again, but he has to be the guy in the tournament. Last year, you could spread that around way more. You know, UNC, Luke Mays made big shots before, but they weren't playing through him when they went and won a championship. That's where he made his name, made the big shot and played well in the tournament, played well in the regionals. He was great. But those guys, you know, Kobe White hasn't done it before. Like, there's going to be a bunch of guys that have to step and make plays, and guys will emerge, without a doubt. I just feel most confident and comfortable looking at him late and looking at their plan as a team of how to win games down the stretch. They know where they're going. They know what they're doing. It's through him.
All right, so let's just do a little bit of big picture stuff. I'll start with this. Of all the teams that are still left in the tournament, who were you most impressed and or most surprised by from the first weekend?
It's a good question. Most impressed is probably, and this is because of, I think their blip in the Big 12 tournament gave me pause. I still put Texas Tech in the Elite Eight when I filled out my bracket, but they were on such a roll down the stretch. In the last 10 games, they were shooting, you know, 42%, I believe, from the three-point line, making 10 threes a game. That's up from low 30s and up from, six threes, just over six threes a game in all the games prior to that. So they look like a different team offensively, coupled with their great defensive capabilities. Now, they just didn't show up against WVU, and they lost that game. But this team looks like the team that looked like the aberration, the WVU performance. It wasn't indicative of anything else to come after because they took care of business the first round. That Buffalo team, man, that's a good basketball team. And they didn't play well yesterday, but sometimes you don't play well because your opponent just imposed its will. And that's what they did. They defended them at a high level. Everything was difficult. Everything was contested. And on the other end, offensively, they were being able to get stops and flow into offense. And Buffalo is a good defensive team themselves that can take you out of what you want to run, that can make you uncomfortable, that can turn you over. Had nothing for them. And I was really impressed by that win and for Texas Tech to move forward. I think they beat Michigan. As I said, I put them in the Elite Eight. That has been a team that I've been particularly surprised by. Another team I'll give love to because of how I saw them coming into the tournament is LSU. You know, a month ago, I said LSU is going to win the SEC championship, at least a share of it. And that was more because they obviously beat Kentucky and Tennessee, but how their schedule lined up down the stretch. Well, they end up winning that thing outright. And you have all this stuff with Will Wade going on. Tony Benford has a really tough SEC tournament in their loss in that game. And this team has found a way, again, to just win tight games. Now, the Yale game, they didn't play particularly well. They defended Yale's best player very well in Mieoni and slowed him down, and that helped get them the win. And Yale didn't shoot the ball well. And that's, again, compliments to some stuff LSU did, some things the other team didn't play well. Now, their next round game, they were able to, what they've done all year, win tight games. And Tremont Waters, whether he took an extra step or not, made the shot that gets them over the top. But they are 5-1 in overtime games down the stretch. I believe now they're 11-4 in games decided by 6 points or less since 11-3, excuse me, decided by 6 points or less since the start of the new year. That's a team you want to, because they know how to win games late. Still, the question remains, is Benford always going to make the right plays on the sidelines? As he gets more comfortable in his role, then they have a better shot of winning. But people, you can't underestimate how important it is to have the guy on the sidelines be totally linked into what's going to happen and feel comfortable and confident that he can lead those guys. So, you know, he needs to continue to grow into his interim role, which is really tough and coming in at a really tough time of the year. But he does have a bunch of dudes on the floor now that, even though young, know how to win tough games. No, Tremont Waters is going to be their closer, and guys make big shots for that team.
Yeah, Skylar Mays has been someone that's really been impressive to me. Just, you know, he had the big three against Maryland when Maryland came all the way back and tied the game. I think there was a minute left, and he banged home that three. And my concern is just, I think that Tony Benford is great in putting together game plans. I think he has done a really good job in just kind of like letting his guys go out and play. Like, he's got dudes on that roster, and you don't really have to do all that much to figure out a game plan to make them be successful. My concern is what happens when somebody makes a tweak, because what we've seen in the three games since he's been the coach in these tournament settings, you know, LSU had a 10-point halftime lead against Florida and lost that game in the SEC quarterfinals. They were up by like 20 on Yale, and Yale came all the way back, and they were within one possession in the final minutes of that game. And then against Maryland, obviously that was a 15-point lead. Maryland throws on his own, and LSU has no idea what to do, and they let Maryland back in and need to get bailed out by Tremont Waters at the buzzer. So that's just my concern with LSU. For me, I think I was most impressed by Auburn. You know, I know kind of what their ceiling is in theory, but to see it like actually come to fruition for, I guess, probably for 73 of the 80 minutes that they played outside of that 7-minute stretch against New Mexico State at the end of the game where they almost gave that thing away. That was not quite as good, but you know, they're as good as anybody at turning defense into offense. It's fun to watch. I'm fired up for this North Carolina Auburn game. I think that might end up being one of the more entertaining games of the season. And when Jared Harper, you know, I don't know if there's a more underrated point guard in the country than Jared Harper. He's really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, that pace of that North Carolina game is going to break our necks. That's going to be fun to watch. It'll be up and down. But to your point about the, you know, how well Auburn has played, it really helps sometimes to get out of conference play. You know, teams get so used to seeing you and know what you're about and know what they need to take away, and you're in these tough environments. It's way different when you haven't seen their speed, their athleticism, their transition, or their ability to knock down shots and get on a roll. And that's what happened to KU. Like, they just hadn't seen it yet, and they were like, holy moly. Before you knew it, it's a 20-point game. And that's – I mean, they were trying. The times you saw Devon Dotson get a shot up, and he finally, after like 6 minutes, just put his head down and just sprint, like actually sprint back, not even almost concerned with the ball. It's just like, let me get back because I'm tired of getting beat down the floor. And that was really impressive to see. And I thought, I mean, I put Auburn in this situation. I thought they'd get to the Sweet 16 and be able to play against Carolina in a game we all want to see. The question now is, are they going to be able to execute, maybe in a half-court game? Because, you know, UNC is going to be able to run with them and be able to keep up the pace for the most part. Be able to keep the pace for the most part. As I return some clothes here, just so you know, this is, again, a real live feel. they'll be able to keep up the pace. Will they be able to make plays in the half-court is the question. And that's the thing we'll have to be able to see, because in the end, the NCAA tournament games are won down the stretch, executing the half court. And that's what it's going to come down to, in my opinion. This game is going to be phenomenal. But I know what you're going to get most of the time out of Carolina in terms of, again, we said it before, guys have been there before. Kobe White's going to show us he can do it on this stage, because he's still going to be a guy who's going to have the ball in his hand. And Harper's excellent. He's outstanding. But are they going to have the other pieces around him? Are they going to be able to rebound, particularly at the level necessary to be able to play with Carolina? I think they will be able to. To be able to play with them. I don't know if they'll be able to beat them, but that game's going to be outstanding. And the biggest key is Auburn being able to get on the glass and compete, because the defensive rebounding percentage, theirs is awful. I mean, it's really bad. And the problem is Carolina's particularly, even though it's not known as a dominant interior team like normal,
Their offensive rebounding percentage is one of the best in the ACC and one of the top 25, I believe, in the country. So they still do what they do, which is get on the glass and cause some problems.
Yeah, I think that Nazir Little is going to be the guy that's the X factor there, because he is, I mean, he could do all the things getting on the glass that you need to do to be able to play like the four for Roy Williams, but he's also athletic enough and has all those physical tools to be able to get out and defend Chuma Okeke and Anthony McLemore. And, you know, to be honest, if there's no missed shots, I don't know if rebounding actually matters. And I think that's kind of what we're heading towards with Auburn and North Carolina. All right, last thing, and then I'll let you go. The thing that disappointed you the most, and I think I'll start with this, is for me, it was Fletcher McGee going 0 for 12. And it's not because, like, I don't want to disparage the kid or anything like that, but I think that he deserved better. You know, we're talking about maybe the best shooter in the history of college basketball, definitely the most prolific. He's the career record holder for most three-pointers made. And to see him go out on an 0 for 12, which is an NCAA tournament record, by the way, to see him go out like that on a stage when he had a chance, maybe if he makes one or two, if he goes 1 for 12 or 2 for 12 from three, Wofford is probably moving on to the Sweet 16. And for him to have to carry that, I mean, that's like the whole Aubrey Dawkins conversation, man. It just, I hate seeing it for that kid, and I hate seeing kids have their careers coming to an end in that fashion.
Yeah, it was tough. And it is a difference, though. When you play at the mid-major level, which obviously we have experience doing that, when you play at the high-major teams, the biggest difference is that guy across from you is 2 or 3 inches taller, runs faster, probably jumps higher, and he's got a little more length on you, and you have to adjust to that. And why I go on that bit of a diatribe is McGee in his career is 12 of 64 playing high-major opponents. That's 19% from the three-point line. So it's one of those things where he has struggled when he has to play against length and athleticism like that. And no matter how prolific he is shooting, and you're right, like his ability to get shots off when his feet literally are facing 90-degree angles away from the basket in the wrong direction, he's able to get the ball up, square his body, and knock down shots. It's absolutely insane. It's almost like something you don't really ever see, especially at the collegiate level. That said, going into that game, I wish he would have thought about, okay, I have to play a little differently than I have before. Not in shot selection. I don't know if he threw one shot fake in there. Now, when you watch the game, watch Nathan Hoover. There were a number of times, shot fake, one dribble, knock down a three. Shot fake, get in the lane, create up a shot for somebody else. Storm Murphy, even. I think McGee was so hungry to go out there and make a big performance on this big stage, coming off a great first game, and now everybody talking about him, making those Steph Curry comparisons. He wanted so much to do it. I don't think he fought the game at the way he needed to be able to succeed in that game against Kentucky, because a lot of those shots are contested. He makes a lot of those contested shots. But as the game is going on, I'd love to see him adjust a bit in terms of using a head fake, getting by a guy, because I believe he was like 4 for 5 in two-point attempts and 0 for 12 from behind the arc. And that's how you have to play him. You got to make him run off the line. But I think he played into their hands a little bit, taking things that are tough. And it is a bummer for him to go out that way. And I think mostly because the difference with Dawkins is he can still say, I played a great game. I'm gonna carry on that miserable feeling. Dawkins will, and people will remember it too. But I think people will always, he can have some solace in the fact that, man, I played well. I just missed. I can't believe I did that. And that's what you have to live with. Fletcher McGee's gonna have to look at himself and be like, man, at the biggest stage, I played arguably the worst game I've played on the offensive end. And I have shot the ball worse than anybody in the history of the tournament. That really hurts for a guy of his caliber. And lastly, because they could have won the game, as you said, if he made a couple of them or made maybe a couple different plays, maybe they do win that game. So that was a bummer to see that. And it's unfortunate, but in some regard predictable, because he had struggled with high major teams throughout his career. And it's a harder level to play at in terms of the athleticism of who you're competing against.
Yeah, it's you know, to your point about him putting the ball on the floor and making a play, I remember at the start of the second half, there were two times where he curled hard off of those down screens instead of looking for the three. And one of them led to, I think he had like a layup in the lane, and the other one, he dumped it down to Cam Jackson for a layup. I think that's what it was. But those are the only two times the entire game. And I want to say it was the first two of their first three possessions, and then we never saw him do it again. So it's sad to see him go out that way. All right, I swear, this is actually the last thing. There are four regions left. What city, if you could pick one city to be in for the regional finals, which city would you pick? I think I would go to Kansas City, but I think Anaheim is pretty intriguing as well.
So I don't have the bracket for Anaheim. Is that Michigan, Texas Tech, and Gonzaga, Florida State?
Yep.
And then Midwest would be
North
UNC,
Carolina,
Auburn.
Yep.
And then Kentucky and
Houston. The East Houston. Is Duke, Virginia Tech, and then Michigan State, LSU. And then the South is Virginia, Oregon, and Purdue, Tennessee.
Well, you could take that one out. I would probably. Yeah, I would go to Kansas City because I do think the most entertaining game is going to be that Auburn-UNC game. And I think in terms of just watching teams go up and down and dudes making plays, I think that's what we're gonna see a lot of that in that game. And the other half of that bracket, I think, is really compelling when you think about Kentucky playing against Houston, because Kentucky's – they're playing without P.J. Washington again. So they're always a story period. But them playing Houston without – if he can't go or he can't go to 100%, that's going to be a tough game because that team's going to guard you, and they're going to make it hard for some of those guards. They're going to have – Corey Davis is a really good point guard. Armani Brooks makes shots. And their whole bench, Dejan Giroux and all the guys come off the bench, have gotten way better throughout the course of the season. So that could be a game that we remember for being a huge upset if that transpires. But the top half of that bracket, that matchup's going to be great. The West is compelling just because I think the Gonzaga-FSU winner, I think whoever comes out of that, I think wins that region. And that game is going to be a fun game to watch, too, with two teams that have some guys that can really score on Gonzaga's side, some good athletes, and some length at Florida State, and obviously a rematch from last year. The thing that took away from you not picking that region is the bottom half with Michigan and Texas Tech. That could be an absolute rock fight. I mean, that could turn into a 52-51 game and just like a war of attrition type situation. Both those teams guard at such a high level. Both of them can really stall offensively. And that game's got to be a blood and guts game. And I think I'd prefer to see the up and down in KC.
Yeah, I'm with you there, especially because we might get North Carolina, Kentucky as an Elite Eight game. Yep. And that would be an unbelievable environment. Listen, Dallin, I'm going to let you go. I know you have some high-level daddy you got to get done. I appreciate you taking some time out of your day while you're shopping and checking out at the – was that a grocery store? Where were you, Old Navy?
I had to return something to Nordstrom. Now I'm going to walk over to Trader Joe's. The best part of this whole podcast, I want you to know, my wife has no idea it happened, and I don't think she'll ever listen. So it's not like I took any time away from what I was already doing. So this is all dad of the year right now going on for the rest of the day.
Oh, I'm proud of you, man. That's some good daddy right there. High level, high major. Thanks for the time,
all
right,
man. Done.
Thanks for listening. Follow me on Twitter.
Give me 5 stars.